Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today we will be talking to the two authors of Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal. The book is published by Cambridge University Press, and the two authors, Kevin Corder and Christina Wahlberg, are here with me today. How are you guys doing?
Good, thank you.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, such a pleasure to have read the book and have you on. I'm sure that you guys have been working on this for a long time, but there couldn't be a more timely time to talk about this in the podcast with the election looming. Before we get to the interesting book, maybe you guys can just do some very brief introductions of who you are and where you are now. Kevin, you are the lead author. Do you want to take the lead in giving your introduction first?
Sure, I'm Kevin Corder, and I'm a professor in the Department of Political Science at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo.
Yeah, and Christina, how about yourself?
Thanks. I'm Christina Wahlberg. I'm an associate professor of political science and the director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at the University of Notre Dame.
Wonderful. You guys have so many other things and affiliations, but I'm in the interest of time and your interesting book, let's get to talking about it. In reading a co-authored book, Kevin, I always suspect that there is some interesting origin story between so how the collaboration began. So I wonder if you could start us off by just telling us a little bit about how this collaboration came to be.
Sure. Well, Christina and I met first in graduate school at Washington University in the early 90s. And when we both started our first jobs, we discussed Gary King's new book. I think it came out when we were both in our second or third year. And Christina brought up the idea that the absence of information about how women voted would be a great application for ecological inference. So we actually started talking about this project at the Midwest Political Science Association meeting in 1998.
Wow. And you've been working on the project ever since. And I mean, this really does seem to be a book that has so many different deep strands. Christina, this is a book with a lot of statistics and also a lot of history. There's in some ways something for everyone in this book. Let's start with some of the history of the subject matter, but the history before 1920. One of the things that I learned in this book is that before ratification of the 19th Amendment, there were some situations where women were given the right to vote. Tell us a little bit about this and how this relates to the 70-year push for women's suffrage.
Well, as most students of American politics would be able to tell you, the struggle for rights and the granting of voting rights in particular, and I think rights in general, is not a unidirectional path where we just sort of constantly move in the direction of the expansion of rights. Rights are granted, rights are taken away. And so you're certainly correct that, for example, at the time of the founding in some American states, widows who owned property were permitted to vote. That only lasted for a short period of time, but there were actually women who cast ballots at the time of the founding. And then the sort of expansion of voting rights for women was really a slow process. As you know, a lot of voting rights really are controlled at the state level. The Constitution doesn't actually say that much about voting, but leaves that to the states. Some states enfranchised women quite early, but for very limited offices that reflected their view of what women were qualified to have a say in. So, for example, as early as 1848, women in Kentucky could vote on school board elections, given women's expertise. The state or territory of Wyoming was the first state to enfranchise women more broadly. And at the time that the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, there was actually a quite large number of states that had either very recently or in the decades before enfranchised women, again, either for a subset of offices or had granted them full suffrage.
Now, Christina, I'd like to stay with you for a second and follow up a little bit on that, related to what is in some ways sort of the starting point of the book, which is about this conventional wisdom about what happened next. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what textbooks have taught us about how women voted after the Constitution was amended. So what have we learned? What is this conventional wisdom? I imagine some of the conventional wisdom that may have launched you on the path of researching for this book.
Well, as we suggest in the book, there's really sort of two sets of conventional wisdoms, I guess. And the first I'm going to call the suffragist failure conventional wisdom. And so I would have people very early on in this project who'd say, well, why are you studying that? We know the answer to that. Women didn't vote, and they all voted just like their husbands did anyway. And that's a conventional wisdom that emerged very early. And so we talk in the book about these headlines in places like Harper's. We may be one of the only pieces of political science research that cites Good Housekeeping, for example, that literally have titles as early as 1924 where they say, was women's suffrage a failure? And what they mean is exactly that basically women were really not taking up their new right. They'd fought so hard for it and now they weren't using it, or they were voting exactly the same as men. That's one conventional wisdom. If you read observers, sort of newspapers and magazines at the time, and if you sort of look at political science, there's a sort of another conventional wisdom sort of lurking in the background. And that's this idea that in certain elections and in certain times, that even in these very first elections, women played a unique role. So to give just one really quite prominent example, the election of 1928 between the first Catholic nominee, Al Smith, and Herbert Hoover, the so-called rum and religion election that really brought up ideas about the role of religion in public life and of prohibition in particular. Many people believe that this was a hugely mobilizing election for women, both over the issues of religion and in opposition to prohibition, but also of immigrant women who were excited by the Al Smith candidacy. And so you sort of have these conflicting views where on the one side, women don't vote and they all vote the same as men. On the other side, these ideas around certain elections that maybe women did play a unique role.
Now, Kevin, there are a number of methodological reasons why this conventional wisdom is not quite right or outright wrong. What was the primary methodological challenge to better understanding women's voting in the 1920s? And how did you two overcome this with your novel data and novel ways in which you analyzed it?
Well, the simple fact is that there just simply were not exit polls, surveys available in the 1920s to help us recover estimates of the voting behavior of women. And in only a couple of cases, which we do leverage, were men and women's ballots counted separately. That was in the state of Illinois. So we really don't have the kind of individual level data in the 20s that we have today. So we had to rely on aggregate data, census data and official election returns at geographic units like cities, wards, and precincts and counties in a number of sample states. So it's the use of aggregate data that we collected and merged that's unique. And then we applied relatively novel, newish strategies for what's called ecological inference to estimate individual level behavior from aggregate data.
Now, we've all learned a little bit about this in the past. Would you give us your quick explanation of this fallacy and how it presents a problem for analyzing this time period with these data?
Sure. Well, you can see it in some of the data that we have. We know what proportion of women and men turned out in Illinois in 1920, and we can look at the aggregate data. And if you look at it in places where there were more women in geographic areas that were high proportion female, you see much higher turnout. So that would lead you to the mistaken inference that women were more likely to turn out. When you look at the individual level data in Illinois, the ballots, you can see that in every geographic area, women were less likely to turn out than men. So that mistaken inference from the aggregate data is the ecological fallacy, and we knew that that was something we had to overcome.
Now, Christina, using some of the approaches that Kevin just described, talk a little bit about sort of the first set of findings. Is our common understanding of this phenomena way off using the reanalysis of the data that you guys have done on these really interesting historical data? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you're focused on. You have selected some specific places. Tell us about sort of what you found.
Well, I'll just briefly mention that the book looks at 10 states. It is not fully representative of the United States, in part because of data challenges that we faced. To do the sort of analysis that Kevin just described would be aided by having a large number, at least usually 100 different observations. The state of Connecticut, for example, has 8 counties, which made it a challenge. Connecticut actually, though, is in our data set, in part because in Connecticut, we were able to get election returns at a much smaller level of aggregation, what the census calls the minor civil division, what you and I know as things like townships and villages. Places out west that we would have loved to have looked at were simply changing their borders. They were so new still that they were still redrawing county lines, and that made it very difficult then for us to merge election returns and census data. So we've got 10 states. While they don't represent the entire United States, they do give us a lot of variation on things like which party was dominant in that state, on the sort of political context, region, a bunch of aspects of the political context that we might think was relevant. And so one of the real contributions we're able to do in this book is to say something about how women voted in these first elections in a much, much wider scope of places than was previously possible. If I could really briefly answer the second part, or at least give a little taste of it. You know,
we're on the edge of our virtual seats waiting.
You can't wait to hear. I would say, you know, like most conventional wisdoms, things were right and things were wrong. And so, for example, on the whole, not only was women's turnout lower than men, but on average, it was much, much lower than men's turnout. So in our 10 sample states in 1920, for example, more than 60% of men turn out to vote in 1920, and less than 40% of women do. But one of the nice things about our project is by looking at this larger sample of 10 states and having the variation that we do have, we're able to see that our answer to even that question about turnout really depends on where you look and how very important context was. In really low competition places where women faced a lot of barriers to turnout, places like the South, so Virginia is one of our states, women's turnout is incredibly low in 1920, less than 10%. Men's turnout is not a whole lot higher than that. But in other states, in our sample, places like Kentucky and Missouri, for example, that were much more competitive politically, and that means that parties had a lot of incentive to get out the vote. There was probably a lot of activity around elections because they were so closely fought, and where barriers to voting, things like registration requirements, were not as onerous. Women's turnout, even in the very first elections, was actually quite high. In Kentucky, we estimate in 1920, about 57% of women turned out to vote in that very first election in which they were eligible. And so a big part of our story is that women's experience as new voters really did depend a great deal on the context in which they first entered the electorate.
Yeah, you know, this issue of context is something that I'm very interested in, the role of parties, the role of competition, but also of mobilization. Kevin, I wonder, you guys touch on this to some extent. Is the amount of mobilization another type of context that matters, or are there other forms of context that are more central to understanding the story?
Well, the two things that we were really able to focus in on the book are the legal restrictions that might set up barriers to voting and the level of competition between the two parties. And those two things put together can be a really powerful influence for how women vote and when. So we looked at mobilization in the sense that I'm wandering here. We looked at mobilization and found that, for instance, in 1928, where, as Christina mentioned at the beginning, there was an expectation that women would be highly mobilized and motivated to participate in the election because of the issues of Roman religion. We found that that was true, but it was also true that men were mobilized, and to some extent to an even greater degree than women. So while the expectation was that the issues and the context and the way that it influenced women's vote would produce this huge spike in mobilization for women, it really produced an equally impressive spike in the mobilization for men. And that's the chapter where we really kind of settle on this idea that you really have to focus not on men or women, but on the context in which both men and women both entered and participated in the electorate.
Yeah, Christina, this is a book of political science, a lot of history in it. But in making sense of this history for other things that matter, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what this more precise understanding of this time period tells you about subsequent time periods. Is there something that helps us understand the later development and mobilization of women and women's participation in politics and other ways that we can better understand through these kinds of very sophisticated findings that you've developed here?
So Heath, I'm given the kind of podcast that you are presenting here, I'm going to take this opportunity to plug our next project.
Oh, fantastic! which you must come back to talk about.
Absolutely. So Kevin and I are working on a book right now, tentatively titled "A Century of Votes for Women," in which we hope to combine our work on this initial period with other new data that's become available, with traditional polls and surveys that your listeners are all familiar with, like the American National Election Study, and sort of tell the story of how women have used the ballot since the 19th Amendment, coming up to its 100th anniversary in 2020. And I guess what I would say is, as you know, in the book, we try to bring together both expectations that were specific to women as voters that were either popular during the time among contemporaries or that you hear from scholars, again, both of that period and those writing about the suffrage period many, many years later, as well as thinking about more general theories and empirical findings that we have in political science about what we would expect of new voters, what we would expect of less motivated or less interested or less experienced voters, what that might lead us to expect for the first women voters. And we really try to bring all those different perspectives to bear and then sort of evaluate how well they work in this particular case. I think in terms of what our book says about thinking about women in politics now or more generally is what sort of constantly surprised me is how much the assumptions and the way that women as voters were understood during that time and by scholars then and immediately following has actually really not changed that much. So ideas that women would care most about things that were very specific to women, that where men might be motivated by the economy or foreign policy or all these other things that we believe about voters in general, women were just going to care about women's issues, however those were defined. And obviously they were defined differently in 1924 than maybe in 1984. That women are naturally more kind and caring and sympathetic, and that this would motivate them to vote for particular kinds of candidates is an explanation that you hear a lot for the modern gender gap and women's support for social welfare policy. And it's an explanation that you really sort of sneaks into a lot of the commentary about women as voters in the 1920s. And so the plug for the next project, and certainly something that we talk about in this book as well, is that I think this recurring way in which our stereotypes and our assumptions about who women are in general and who they are as women as political actors shapes and even maybe biases how we interpret and understand what data and information we do have about women as political actors. What we believe that to mean or to reflect is not neutral, but is shaped by a lot of assumptions and stereotypes.
Yeah, and Kevin, along that point, you very early in the book, you do make the point that much of your data and much of the focus is on not all women at the time period, but certain groups of women. I wonder if that issue of who was permitted to vote in the 1920s versus who actually was able to vote changes the way in which this story goes as you move ahead. You talk about this more recent project that you're working on that, mm-hmm. that looks to connect this up to later data. Are you able to broaden the analysis then to African American women and Latino women with future data that is maybe more fine grained than you were able to grab for the earlier time period? Talk about that other context that this exists in.
Well, that's one of the things that we're really trying to approach in a new way in the new book, is that we know after 1965 and the Voting Rights Act that we're going to have a tremendous expansion of the number of women of color who are participating in elections, and that's going to be an important change to the electorate for women as a whole. So that's something that we really want to focus on, because we're aware that in the 1920s, when we're talking about women in the early elections, it's more native-born women, and in later elections of the early 30s, perhaps more immigrant women, but still, that leaves still a large proportion of the eligible female electorate out of this picture. And so we're going to look at that. And I just wanted to add, one of the big surprises for me in this work was when we found that women were less likely to support the progressive candidate in 1924. And that just upended a whole lot of expectations about how women were going to be distinctive and progressive-oriented voters. And so that was a first hint to me that the story about how women entered the electorate and what the implications were was really kind of inadequate, and that we needed to do some more empirical work to understand that.
Yeah. Christina, in the interest of surprises, and also given that this podcast is going to be broadcast on the eve of the election, are there any things that you take away for trying to understand what's going to happen within the electorate in this election? Are there surprises about how turnout is going to look that you think are informed by what you've learned about the past?
I think, as we've been suggesting, that this distance between our assumptions about who women are, that the extent to which we often spoke about women voters as some undifferentiated mass, and we missed the fact that immigrant women are not the same as native-born women, that women of color in the South were systematically denied access to voting rights until the 1960s, that, Latina women in the Southwest all had very different experiences with the vote, and that the things that motivate women voters are often not actually as different from those things that motivate male voters. While at the same time, we do see throughout our history these what we now call a gender gap, but sort of different patterns, maybe not enormous, but here and there, different patterns of vote support. I would expect to see that in 2016 as well. This is going to be a really challenging election, I think, for those of us interested in women as voters to understand, because obviously we have the first woman nominee in American history. We also have the other major party nominee, who is also distinctive in his expression of gender roles. And so how those two factors combine to influence and affect how women vote will surely be the subject of multiple dissertations at minimum.
That is the most optimistic way I think that anyone can lead us into the election. And so a future of dissertations is a very silver lining to a very bumpy, I'm not mixing the metaphor, but I think you get the point. I enjoyed the book just so much. Again, the title of the book is Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal. The authors, Kevin Corder and Christina Wahlberg. The publisher is Cambridge University Press. I hope that before Election Day, before you vote, you go out and get this book. It's really, really interesting. Kevin and Christina, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heath.